All right, and you're back in the room. And welcome aboard, Mr. Jonathan Haidt.
You got it. You're the first person in the world to say it correctly.
Are you serious?
Most people say Haidt, but I'd much rather have Haidt.
I was joking off air that that potentially could be a microaggression for you if you took it that way. People asking how to say your name over and over.
Oh, I'm not easily offended, but so I need to leave America.
Welcome aboard. You've only just gotten the country about 3 hours ago, and you've come straight to 95BFM, and we appreciate it.
I have. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan, for those of our listeners that are not 100% familiar with you or your areas of, academia, what's your focus in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, I'm a social psychologist who studies morality and the moral motivations that drive politics and that are driving my country, the United States, insane. And I'm a professor at New York University.
Okay. Cool. Something that was interesting to me, I watched a couple of podcasts in the last few days, as one does before speaking to someone, and I was interested in anti-fragility and in a digital world, how we foster or create anti-fragility.
Yeah, this is the key concept. If I leave New Zealand with just leaving one thing behind, it's an understanding of the word anti-fragile or anti-fragility.
Perfect, John. Great question.
And we didn't set this up. Actually, we didn't. But so it's...
Oh, hang on.
Don't know what that is.
I'll shut this door.
Okay. But anti-fragile is a word that was invented by Nassim Taleb, who's an author who wrote the book The Black Swan. And it's meant to describe systems that are the opposite of fragile. A fragile thing breaks if you drop it, so you have to protect it. But an anti-fragile thing needs to be dropped. It can't get strong unless it gets challenged and tested. And so the immune system is the great example. If you protect your kid's immune system, you're actually crippling it, because kids need to be exposed to dirt and germs in order for it to grow. And kids are the same way. If we overprotect them, they don't learn the basic strength and toughness to deal with insults and teasing and getting lost and all sorts of other things.
This is basically developing a more robust young human being, thanks to just sort of having some healthy conflicts in their life.
Being like gently tested throughout their life.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's how kids grow. Kids don't really grow from you dictating to them, don't burn your finger on the stove. They learn by burning their finger once on the stove, and then they don't do it again. Mm-hmm. And so this has been a catastrophe in the United States, in that we've been so grossly overprotecting our kids. They're not able to go off to college and face normal setbacks. Same thing in Canada and the UK. Australia is not quite as bad as us. And as far as I can tell, New Zealand is the only English-speaking country that has not gone crazy for overprotection. You actually let your kids climb trees. We don't anymore.
Right, mm-hmm. right. I often think maybe, and this is just a New Zealand perspective, but I often think that maybe country kids have had it a little bit more. Couldn't you get to muck around a little bit more than you would if
yes.
you grew up in a city?
No, that's right. There's a big country-city difference. Mm. But suburban areas are exactly as bad as cities. So even when kids could climb trees, they're not allowed to.
Right.
Now, one thing that you have over us is you have many fewer lawyers, and you have a much better health system. So in New Zealand, if a school lets kids climb trees and a kid falls and gets hurt, the parents are not going to sue. That's right.
Right.
That's
right. I did wonder about that, actually. Yeah.
So we've kind of got this situation where parents are being somewhat more protective of children at the moment. We've got the rising use of social media, which is meaning children are spending more time in front of screens and having mm-hmm. less face-to-face contact, which is kind of like been an essential part of our evolution since the dawn of time. What part is social media playing in modern, development of people?
Yeah. Well, so first we need to get something on the table really clearly, which is that rates of anxiety and depression began rising very rapidly around 2012, 2013 in America. And it was especially for the girls. The girls get hit much harder, and especially the preteen girls. Mm. Well, and you can tell all kinds of stories. What happened in 2012 in America? But it turns out it's the exact same in Canada, same in the UK, same in Australia.
Wow.
Now, I've gotten some data on New Zealand. I'm still going through it, so I can't say with confidence that you have the same pattern, although there's been a lot of journalism about rising rates of depression and anxiety mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And it's not just self-report. It's not just like kids saying, oh, I'm so depressed because it's cool to be depressed. It's like self-harm rates, like the girls cutting themselves, and it's also suicide. Mm. So something big is happening around the world, at least I can say with confidence for the English-speaking countries. And what we think happened, Greg Lukianoff and I, he's my co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, what we think happened is the combination of vast overprotection, which began in the 1990s, and then these same kids, Gen Z, kids born in 1996 and later, these same kids get onto social media in around age 10 or 11, which is too early. Mm. And the combination means that they've been deprived of all the normal tussles and conflicts of face-to-face interaction, and instead they've had conflicts online, but those don't seem to make them tougher. They seem to make them more fearful. Yeah. Public shaming seems to have a very different effect than face-to-face conflicts.
Why do we hold so much currency in online stuff? I mean, is it just
why
because,
does who hold currency?
Well,
who,
just people, everyone.
People get
everyone
sucked into
it. Like just before I posted about you coming on, and I had a look, see if anyone liked it. Thanks for liking it, by the way.
Well, look, there you go. So we all get sucked into it. Now, look, I don't want to catastrophize here. Catastrophizing is making catastrophe out of things. Mm. And obviously, there's some good effects of social media, too.
Right, right.
But I think what we can say pretty clearly from looking at the mental health stats is that when you get social media in college at the age of 18 or older, it doesn't seem to hurt you. So the millennial generation, which got Facebook in college, they're not harmed. Their rates of anxiety and depression are not really up.
Yeah.
It's getting it when you're 10, 11, 12, like in the height of bullying and cruelty and insecurity.
You've got coping mechanisms if you're a bit older.
Yeah. You let your brain develop first. Let your basic social nature develop first. Then let kids be on social media.
Okay, so it's an age thing. It's basically restricting access to social media when you're developing.
I think so. I think we're probably going to settle on something like no kids should be on social media until the age of 16. That's what, you know, it's hard to pick a specific age, but the current age is 13 and everybody just lies and gets on at age 11, 12. That's got to stop because the results are just, it's just too many kids in the hospital and actually dead.
Yeah. How far away are we from getting policy that would sort of set standards like that? Would that be a global thing or is this going to be more of a local, you know,
Yeah. Well, I think, Facebook is not going to do it on its own. So it's Facebook and Instagram. Let me be really, really clear. Mm. This is not about iPhones. This is not about screen time or watching videos. This is only about social media. It's only about platforms where a kid can post something and then hundreds of people can say bad things about them publicly so that they can't sleep that night because they're so shamed and humiliated.
Yeah.
It's just about social media. And so I think it's going to take a lot of different countries really harassing. What the platforms really don't want is lots and lots of different rules for different countries. Mm. But if lots of countries push, and America is not likely to push, if lots of countries push, I think they might eventually just raise the age. Also, I'm hoping there'll be a gigantic lawsuit. I think there will eventually be a gigantic lawsuit.
Right.
And so the sooner they act on that, the less culpable they'll be.
It all happened so fast, didn't it? And we're all just trying to figure it out. That's kind of the problem, isn't it? Nobody saw all this coming in this sort of intensity and the merit that would come with it.
No, that's right. Like when you invent the printing press and it transforms European society, well, that took like, 100 or 200 years.
Yeah. Mm.
And this thing, it's invented, sort of goes public in 2006 when it's open to the world. But it only really develops the intensity after 2009 when Facebook adds the like button. Mm. That's the crucial innovation that allowed every kid to reinforce every other kid instantly. Mm-hmm. That's when it gets much more addictive. That's when kids go online intensely. So it's really only since about 2011 that society has been online, including teenagers. And then sure enough, around 2012, 2013, the rates of depression and anxiety go up.
Fascinating.
Do we have time to sort of chat a little bit about wokeness online and aggressive wokeness online?
Oh, my favorite topic. Yes. So you have that word here, wokeness?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I hadn't heard wokeness until I watched
one.
But I'd heard the word woke.
Yeah. So, there's a metaphor of awakening, waking up to something that you hadn't seen before. And it's, it's red pill in the Matrix, it's Buddha and his enlightenment. And so the original idea of wokeness is that one wakes up to see the pervasiveness of racism and the horrors of what African Americans went through and still go through to some extent, indignities. So there is something real about being woke. There is something to that. But that would be great if it was then linked to compassion. Instead, what happened, we now have data on this, is that white people on the left, white progressives on the left, really got really radical around 2014. Mm. A lot of things really changed, not for black people, but for white people. They get really woke, and then they start calling out anybody they can.
It's very, I told you so.
Well,
kind of
imagine since everybody is in a desperate struggle for prestige, imagine that suddenly in 2014, somebody changes the rules of your local game. And so if you're a white progressive, now suddenly you don't get points for being compassionate. You get points for finding hidden racism. Mm-hmm. Somebody says something simple and you say, well, that's racist. Mm-hmm. And you call it out. So that's the game that began, that's the transformation that hit the social structure in around 2014. And that's what we call the Great Awokening.
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, we just made that up in America in the last year, just because the data just came in that something big happened in 2014. So this is all before Trump. And then when Trump comes in, then understandably the whole country loses its mind.
Huh. It causes obviously like this bigger division between everyone, doesn't it? Rather than...
It's very us versus them. And it's yeah. I guess that's a lot to do with like the strange... I mean, I'm just kind of getting my good grips of the left versus right type of... And really, the world should just be what's right and wrong, not what's left and right. It's so strange, the whole...
But what's right and wrong is sort of a continual
what you're taught, I
work
guess.
And process. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, so politics, you know, politics should be a good thing. Politics should be the system by which people of different views work it out. And, you know, whoever can make a better case to the mass public wins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not going to be one conception of right versus wrong, especially right. if you've got diversity in your society. So I'm actually a big fan of like normal politics, in which you have progressives who are pushing for change and who see that some things we took for granted are not fair. And you got conservatives who say, wait, don't burn everything down right now. Like, wait, let's proceed cautiously.
Right.
So that's normal politics. And that's what we had in America until, well, it gradually began to unravel in the late 90s, and then it accelerates in the 2000s. And then social media really puts a torch to it, in my opinion.
I think like when it comes to arguing in politics, it seems to me one of the problems is someone will take certain facts and they'll know the other facts mm-hmm. that need to be presented as well, and they won't say them just because they're trying to win an argument. They're losing mm-hmm. sight of the bigger picture of just trying to make everything genuinely better.
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine, so I think the thing to keep your eye on is how the game changes once social media comes in, because you know, you can have an argument with someone, and then if you just sit down and you talk about, let's suppose you're, you know, your husband, your wife, or boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it is, and if you can often work things out in private, and you mm-hmm. can make a good apology, and you can say, you know what, I admit, you're right about X,
yes.
but I want to stick on Y, and you can do that. But what if you have 1,000 people looking on,
right. yeah.
and they're going to zap you as soon as you give
everyone's
an inch?
Everyone's got an ego.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
How on earth are we going to sort of deal with something, you know, like aggressive wokeness? Is there any way that we can temper this situation or improve it? What sort of mm-hmm. tools can we teach people for, you know, online behavior?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, stuff that you yeah. take for online into the real world. Where do we start with something mm-hmm. like this?
Well, I would start by looking at the United States and resolving to not be like us. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm giving a talk here in Auckland on Thursday, and the gist of my talk is I come to you as the ghost of Christmas future, the ghost of liberal democracy's future,
yeah.
You know, warning you, don't be like us. I mean, we're in big, big trouble. Yeah. It's really not so clear to me that our democracy is going to make it through this period, because we have such low trust. So anyway, my point is, realize that there's a crisis of democracy all around the world. As far as I can tell, you're much more sane here. You're not as intense. But you recognize, so you have a couple years jump on us. You have a sort of a head start, and realize democracy is hard. You have to educate for democracy. And part of that means when you see something that you think is bad or wrong, try resolving it privately first. Don't jump to calling people out publicly. Public shaming is maybe good for you. It gets you points, but it pollutes the public space. It turns people against you. It doesn't win people to your cause. So it's just a way of showing off.
Right.
The more you can shame wokesters, the more you can shame people who just call out others, the better.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, there still seem like a nasty intentions sometimes.
And just looping back to raising children in the digital world, your couple of key takeaway facts of, you know, like raising a young person is kind of like restricting screen time. Having allowing unsupervised play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's break it up into two things. So you've got to make your kids stronger. So you've got to give them a lot more experiences. And again, I can't come here to New Zealand and lecture you. You're the last people who do this. But don't get sort of a American disease where you start worrying, oh my God, my 8-year-old is going out into the woods with his friends. What if he's kidnapped? Mm. Don't do that. Kids have to have a lot of unsupervised time. So you're doing that. So just keep doing that. Don't change. The social media thing, though, I've been looking at the stats online. You're going down the same road as everyone else.
Yeah. Mm.
So listeners, if you want to go to thecoddling.com, the webpage for the book, I have a page there of statistics on New Zealand, newspaper articles. You can see what's going on in your country. But any parents out there, three simple pieces of advice. Until we know for sure what's going on, why depression's going up, three simple pieces of advice. Rule number one, all devices, all screens out of the bedroom by a fixed time, at least a half hour before bedtime. There's no reason to let your teenagers especially have a device at night. It's going to cut into their sleep because they're checking.
You can't sleep. Yeah. Even as a grown man, that light on my face when I'm in bed doesn't help me sleep.
Even if you turn off notifications, you're still going to be checking. So that's rule number one. Rule number two, no social media until at least age 14. And I would say 16, but I understand that's not realistic yet. But keep your kids off and talk to your friends' parents. No, kids should not have social media when they're 11, 12 years old. And rule number three, work out a time budget. I can't tell you that 2 hours a day is safe or not safe. I can't tell you that. But if you don't work out a budget with your kids, there are 1,000 psychologists in Silicon Valley whose job is to keep your kid on the device all the time. And they're very good at it. So work out a time budget with your kid.
Mm. So your talk tomorrow is Thursday. Is about coddling of the American mind, something that you've written.
Yes, that's right. So I'll be covering some stuff from my current book, which is The Coddling of the American Mind, and some from my last book, which is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And I wrote that in 2012 before things got horrible in my country.
How do you settle on these topics? How do you get to the point where you're like, oh man, I've got to research this and I really want to figure it out?
Oh, it's a different story for each book, but The Righteous Mind was the summary of my life's work, my research on moral psychology, especially as I got very concerned about the culture war in America. I was always on the left, and I originally started the book to help the left stop losing to the right. But as I committed to understanding everybody, I realized that you actually have to read different views to understand what's going on. So I actually have a lot of respect for sort of classical, like Edmund Burke type conservatism, libertarianism. And then the coddling was a very different story. My friend Greg Lukianoff came to me in 2014 and said, John, something weird is happening on college campuses. Suddenly students are acting all afraid of words and books. They're asking for limitations. So I joined him in trying to figure out this mystery of this was the Great Awakening. We didn't know it at the time, but something weird was happening in 2014, and then it exploded on campuses in 2015. So that led first to an article in The Atlantic and then to the book in 2018.
And you were having to sort of tiptoe around topics these days.
Oh my goodness!
That reducing vibe? Is that kind of spreading or getting worse?
It's getting worse. So the shout downs, the really aggressive and quasi violent stuff has mitigated. There's not as much of that, but it's in part because everyone's walking on eggshells now.
Yeah.
I don't want to exaggerate. It's not literally everyone, but at the elite schools and where I am at New York University and at all the Ivy League schools, if you're teaching in the social sciences or the humanities. If you're talking about anything to do with race, gender, politics, immigration, equality, anything that has any political ramifications, you can't be provocative anymore. It used to be, professors since Socrates were supposed to be provocative.
Yeah,
and now
conversation
we can't, otherwise we'll be reported for microaggressions.
So is that privilege of sorts?
If it's these
fancy universities, does it come from a path of like these students think that they sort of have this right to do this because they go to the big fancy university?
It's not based on that you're at a fancy university. It's based on victimhood points. If you can claim enough victimhood points, then you have the ability to call others out, but no one can call you out. And, it might seem like, isn't that leveling the playing field? But you really don't want to give people advantages or disadvantages based on race or gender or anything else. In the long run, you're hurting them if you do that.
Right. I actually just wanted to touch on, I saw you on a Joe Rogan podcast, and I enjoy his podcast a lot.
Yeah, that was great fun.
How did that come about?
His booker invited me to come on.
Cool.
I guess either, he or somebody on the team had read one of my books. Mm-hmm. This was a couple months after the Coddling the American Mind came out. And Joe Rogan's audience is, it's going to be a lot of people who know what's going on college campuses and are concerned about this and are generally tougher. They don't go in for the woke microaggression stuff.
Right on. Going down at, was it the Bruce Mason?
Bruce Mason Theatre on Thursday evening. You can still get tickets.
I think we do have a ticket to give away. So if somebody would like to catch Jonathan Haidt tomorrow at the Bruce Mason Centre, give us a text on 5395. John, is anybody? There's a couple of texts coming in. We just thought maybe
we have had a couple of texts. Someone's just said, why is social media so detrimental as opposed to a classroom?
Well, in
ambiguity, right?
Okay. Well, in a classroom, it's a community that has some obligations, some norms, some civility develops. Mm. You got face to face. I can read a classroom, but social media is open to the world, yeah. and it's not a reflection of what the average person thinks. What you hear is just the most extreme people who have made a habit of calling others out or showing off. So it's a sick forum in which to interact, especially for kids.
Right.
Mm. Just a couple other ticks about people feeling vindicated for bringing up their kids with limited access to screens in the bedroom. They play in the mud and climb in trees.
Yeah, good. Jonathan, was there anything you wanted to leave us with that you feel we absolutely have to know? If we're not,
it's that it really is that that democracy is hard. That a lot of other countries are sort of falling over a cliff, and you're not so far, but keep it that way. You can't just go on assuming everything will be okay. There are huge technological and social changes. It seems as though your Gen Z is becoming more depressed and anxious. So you've really got to look into these trends, learn from what's happening in America, Canada, and the UK, and guard yourselves against, I am the ghost of Christmas. Yeah. Liberal democracy's future. Don't be like us. That's my closing message.
We really we appreciate your research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Haidt, everybody. Going down at the Bruce and Mason Center.
Thursday.
Tickets at thinkinc.com. What is it?
.org? I think it's org.
Well, if you Google thinkinc.
Thinkinc will follow your nose.
Yeah, you'll find it.
Easy peasy. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
95 BFM.